as an industry, we could do a much better job supporting one another and figuring out how to just grow the size of our little part of the pie. And I think it comes in the form of like an abundance mindset. It comes in the form of like being really clear about the customer value that we're providing instead of counter positioning against the banks, right? We've seen a lot of that counter positioning, and it doesn't work. It doesn't help your customer understand the why, and it doesn't create any urgency for them.
This is Retained Learnings, a podcast where Canadian finance leaders share strategic advice and potential solutions to answer some of the finance department's most important questions. I'm your host, Rob Kazam, the founder and CEO of Float. Thanks for listening, and I hope you learned something from today's episode.
Today, I'm looking forward to sitting down with Jeremy Black. He's the principal consultant at Kinvi, where he works with Canadian fintechs, premier global crypto businesses, and their bank sponsors to identify opportunities, define roadmaps, and launch products. Jeremy's definitely no stranger to myself or Float. He's been a friend and a mentor for a long time, since the earliest days of the inception of Float. So it's exciting to welcome here Jeremy Black.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
So to start, give everyone a bit of context on who you are, your career, where it started, where it went, where it is now. Just a bit of a purview of all the amazing experience and perspective you have.
I started my career at a technology company here in Toronto called Extreme Labs. It was a wonderful experience. They were one of the earliest sort of advocates for the startup ecosystem in the city, and those guys still continue to start businesses and build them here today. We were acquired by a very large enterprise software company. I ended up leading the business in Canada, and of course, when you work for a large enterprise software company, you work with the banks. Part of what we did with these financial institutions was look at their long-term roadmaps, because we were helping them move from these on-prem data centers, which doesn't make a lot of sense for them to run today, to cloud infrastructure. All of the small business and corporate work was 7 to 10 years out. This was 2016. So we're about 7 to 10 years out now. Has meaningful change happened within these institutions in terms of the way they serve small businesses and corporate clients? I would say likely no. And so I started a small business focused neobank when I left that position leading the enterprise software company. We did it in the US. We were the second ever to launch in the US, small business focused neobank. We built it on top of a regulated financial institution. Ultimately ended up selling that business to Wave Accounting, which another Toronto-based company here. And I've been investing and advising fintechs ever since.
Did you know you wanted to do this when you were younger? Did you know it was a career in entrepreneurship, a career in technology, or did you fall backwards into it?
I think it was intentional, but there was a trigger, right? So there is a guy named David Crow who used to run meetups in Toronto in the very early nascent days of the ecosystem here. And at some point, he decided that he was going to take this thing from bars to the Scotiabank Theater. And so he had Fred Wilson come in from Union Square Ventures and a host of other folks. And I attended this event and I saw this job in technology. And I kind of made that decision then and there that I was going to go and get that job. And that was how I landed in the technology business.
What are some of the projects you're currently working on that you're excited about?
I think they all start from the same point, which is, you know, someone like yourself, usually the CEO or somebody else on the executive team at a fintech that just feels like they've got something they really want to do, but they just can't get it going because they can't create more of their own time to do that. And oftentimes this takes some combination of like being an entrepreneur and being, you know, excited about ambiguity and being willing to take risks that you might fail. And then of course, like deep product knowledge around fintech is a very technical domain. And I don't mean technical from the engineering perspective, but technical from the perspective of like, how does your bank think about third-party risk management? Like you have to understand that stuff really well. All of the projects that we engage in are going from that like zero to something moment. We're doing a credit and lending business for somebody right now, which we're really excited about. I'm helping a customer in London in the UK stand up a business around an EMI license that they've got. So that's my first exposure to that market, which is pretty exciting. Yeah.
Nice. Huge exposure and perspective on the market. So you tweeted something recently that really resonated with a lot of folks, and it's about a painful experience you had doing a simple wire transfer. Would love for you to share with our listeners where that came from and maybe the broader point of view on Canadian fintech, what's going on here, why there is a sense of frustration. What is behind that? Like, what is the Coles notes of what the landscape looks like today and what are some of the challenges that we as a country and as a fintech community are navigating?
I like that you said Coles notes, like I'm going to give you an abbreviated version.
Don't give me that.
We're going to go the distance. Yeah. So the frustration was the fact that I had to drive to the bank, which anybody that lives in or around Toronto knows is like no matter what, half an hour each way probably. I arrive there and I wait in line and then I get to the front and I've got to send this wire payment. It's for like $2,000 or something, right? But the person won't accept an e-transfer. And I go to do this and it just kind of dawns on me, like I've been here before. Like I've been starting businesses in one way, shape or form since I was 20 years old. My first one in university and I couldn't tell you the number of times that I've had to go to a branch to do something. And I know that's an easy thing to like pick on with the banks, but I think it's, indicative of a much larger problem, which is that without competition, we don't get better customer experiences, better value, lower prices. Mm. I think most people would agree with that. So if you zoom out for a moment and you think about the fact that we've got 35 Schedule I banks in this country, maybe 34 by the time National Bank finishes acquiring Canadian Western Bank. There's not a lot of incentive to innovate, and there's some structural and regulatory reasons for that as well, which we can get into. But yeah, I mean, the effect of my tweet was like, if I think about your customer base, like, there are times when your customers have had to show up at a branch for something that felt like it should have been, a 30-second task, sitting exactly where they were in that moment. And I think if we were to add up the number of those instances in a given day in this country, and you were to think about the cost of that economically, the cost of my time, the cost of your customer's time, and then all of the ways that manifests itself across the entirety of our financial services experience in this country, whether it's in a commercial context or a consumer context, I think the number is shocking. Mm. We often talk about this like with traffic, right? It's, what is the cost of all of this traffic, right? Like, what is the cost of all of the congestion in financial services? That's my question.
Yeah. And you're obviously sort of an expert on the field, no doubt. I'm sure I've looked globally. Help someone understand listening that's never been outside of Canada or just doesn't know much about other financial systems. Like, where would you place Canada's banking services today, degree of innovation and competition from a consumer lens, or a business lens? Well, like, where would you stack rank us?
I think that it's really easy for us, in answering this question and many questions to just immediately look south and do the compare and contrast there. Their market is very different. There's 5,000 banks in the United States. There's 5,000 credit unions in the United States. Even if you were to apply, the same factor here with our under 400 credit unions now, there's just a lot more concentration in the market here, both in terms of number of participants, but then also like who the top sort of five or six are. Although the US is fairly concentrated as well amongst, B of A and JPMC and Wells and so on. I would say that it's less about the financial services sector and more about our approach to competitiveness overall, right? I think while I don't agree necessarily with like a lot of the statements that I've heard from other entrepreneurs over the last 3 or 4 months in respect of the, you know, the changes to the capital gains inclusion rate, I will say that the underlying sentiment is just this feeling that we don't have enough respect or advocacy for risk in this country. And so when I look south of the border, or if I look somewhere like the UK where I'm doing some work today, you know, they've created through implicit permission or explicit regulation the conditions for more competition. And so I would rank us very low on that point. That's not to suggest that we can take their model and just apply it here and it's going to work. But I think the overarching point is that we just need more competitiveness across the board.
Super helpful. So, you know, one of the key insights you highlighted, if you look at the number of participants in the industry in the US versus Canada, even adjusting for Canada being, you know, 1/10 the size, that there's way more competition. And then you mentioned also the sort of stifling regulatory environment. Could we go a layer deeper? So we now know and understand that there's a much smaller number of banks in Canada, and the regulatory regime culture today, as you've sort of highlighted, doesn't promote risk-taking, or it's unnecessarily or too risk-averse. What do you think kind of contributes to that? What are some of the examples of regulations or regimes that prevent new entrants into the banking market and lack of innovation, even through partnership with the existing players that exist today?
As I said, you know, 35 Schedule I banks. You're going to have to partner with one of these institutions in order to access, whether it's like payment rails or regulated products. You're going to require that partnership. And so of those 35, of course, there is a set of them that are just fine without us, right? They're not super interested in supporting this sector. And I think there are very good reasons why, and I wouldn't expect them to. So that's fine.
And that's the six major banks.
Yeah, the six, you know, systemically important domestic banks, right? Yeah. Although they do partner with fintechs, that's not to suggest that they're not engaged in some way, but like when it comes to truly disruptive, customer-centric experiences, the types of experiences that like Float, ShakePay, Wealthsimple, Loop, I'm just going to name some friends, try to deliver in the marketplace, they're not super interested in that type of competition. And so it would stand to reason that the others, though, would be, right? So there are 25 or so long-tail banks outside of those, plus a few other large ones, that are engaged across the economy in doing commercial lending, very specific types of commercial lending to developers or for property, plant, and equipment, for commercial operations that are scaling up. And these banks want to partner with companies that are going to build software to better distribute their products. That's what this is all about, right? And I feel like the biggest challenge in creating more competitiveness is OSFI, our bank regulator. They have some guidance around third-party risk management, which the banks take very seriously and OSFI takes very seriously, and rightfully so, right? If one of the big six banks was to show up today and say, we're going to rewrite our entire core ledgering system with some unproven technology, I would like OSFI to have a comment on that. But I think this extends pretty deeply into the day-to-day lives of people trying to innovate in the space. And so far as OSFI, I believe, actively discourages the types of partnerships that you have with your sponsor bank, which is People's Trust. And People's Trust, for their part, you know, they are, I would say, 80 to 90% of the market for fintech in Canada. And what I mean by that is they're powering 80 to 90% of the fintech programs in Canada, the throughput, whether you want to consider it payment volume or just pure number of customers sitting on top of that platform. And they've done a really good job. And without them, we would likely be nowhere. But the reality is that they have sort of reached some escape velocity where they're doing this and they're doing it well and they've proven it to OSFI. And I believe that behind closed doors, OSFI is explicitly and implicitly telling others that they're not super sure they should be engaged in this type of activity. And that's pushing everybody through a single door. And that makes it very difficult because people's trust can only do what they do at the level of quality they do it at for so many people. Right.
And why do you think that is, that dynamic where people's trust is encouraged or, you know, whether implicitly or explicitly to do that, but for example, RBC or BMO or one of the other major banks is not?
I'm actually suggesting the opposite, which is that, you know, people's trust is doing this and they've sort of, they've carved a path, but I believe that, that our bank regulator
doesn't want others
to go down the same path. Mm. Right. And I've heard that directly from them and they would never say that publicly because of course the relationship is very important, but that's the reality.
And what do you think that is, like a layer deeper? What is it about, the risk presented by fintechs that you think might lead to OSFI saying this might not be a good idea to expand further?
I suspect it's that OSFI doesn't have an innovation mandate and they are an institution with such great power and such great influence that to counterbalance their focus on risk mitigation would be very difficult. Mm. As part of that tweet that you referenced earlier, I may have also made a comment about that counterbalancing of power. It feels to me like, to some degree, elections are our only way to do that. Like, this is kind of, we have one shot, and it appears that we're going to get a new federal government, which is going to create some meaningful opportunity for change, but it's one shot every 4 years, right? And they have to have a strong mandate and they have to care deeply enough about this, which, so, you know, I think it's about creating that counterbalance. Like, who is bearing the torch for innovation that is going to help OSFI and others get more comfortable with any risk at all?
Yeah. So there's really multiple layers, right? We have a concentrated banking sector. We have, it sounds like, a reluctant regulator and one fintech partner, banking partner that has done a good job. We've obviously partnered with them. You're well aware of People's Trust. But that model is certainly not being encouraged by the regulator. And then you have challenges associated with, you know, becoming a bank. You have challenges associated with accessing banking rails. Maybe could you spend a couple of minutes, you know, you hear a lot about real-time rails and open banking. What does this mean? Like, to the layperson, why does this matter within the context of what we're talking about?
I'll just tell you about my own experience. I am a small business owner. I have this advisory practice. I have one partner. We have an executive assistant. There's three of us at this business. I actually enjoy doing bookkeeping, as crazy as that sounds. And so, you know, it is easier for me to go to my bank's website and download the file and then go over to QuickBooks and upload that file than it is for me to maintain some connection between QuickBooks and that bank. And there's many reasons why that connection is failing, and there's many reasons why there's many parties involved in why that connection is failing. But the reality is that it's failing, and I have to think about that, and that is distracting me from doing the things that are going to help grow my business and hopefully grow the businesses of my clients. And so that, in some very small way, is a good sort of extrapolation of the larger problem here, which is that the ability to move the money and the ability to reconcile the data is not in and of itself going to create any competitive advantage for any business in this country or make any consumer more creative or more valuable out in the marketplace. They're table stakes, and we don't have that today. And until we do, it's very difficult for companies like Float to continue to advance the innovation that needs to happen on top, right? Like at some point, if the software's job is to move the money and reconcile the data, you're going to need a little bit more access and control over how and when the money moves and how the data is ingested and put out into the world.
Yeah. And, you know, like one of the examples we talk about a lot at Float that resonates with people is just really simple. How long does it take to move money? You know, like what's the actual settlement timeline? What's your assessment of that today? You know, if we're looking at like EFT rails or bill pay rails, you know, what's the status quo today in Canada? What's the equivalent in the US or a market that we should look to at least for some form of a North Star?
I mean, I'll go, you know, the US is very challenging. The equivalent of EFT in the US, which is the ACH system, which means automated clearinghouse. Effectively, every country has an automated clearinghouse. They've just, theirs is kind of branded. It has, I would say, even more challenges in some ways than the EFT system here. And part of the reason for that is because the space is so large. How do you get 5,000 banks and 5,000 credit unions all sort of working on the same timelines? I think the money is moving fast enough in some sense. And what I mean by that is, you know, if I have to make a supplier payment and the payment lands tomorrow because I initiated it today, like that's a pretty good level of service in terms of like the actual money. Mm. But the problem becomes reconciliation. I made the payment today. You received the payment tomorrow. It is hard for us to have a single view of what happened because what happened in between is so opaque and there's like a time lag. And so even in your business, you would have, you know, an incredible amount of reconciliation challenges to solve based on those time differences and how you want to and need to report what has happened to, you know, all the stakeholders of a transaction. It's that. I mean, that's unnecessary friction. So I don't think it's necessarily about like, Rob, I really need to get Rob that money. Mm-hmm. It's more about the pain that it causes afterwards and how much time we're spending reconciling a thing that if it just happened in real time, everybody would have a shared understanding of.
Yeah.
Right.
But there are timelines. I mean, you know, if you look at loading money into a wallet at a fintech or an account, you know, it's a multi-day, multi-business day clearing yes. process. And so, you know, in this interest rate environment, you know, 3 or 4 business days of dead capital in a month is, yep. it adds up. It's a real challenge.
Let me actually take that one with you then, because you're making a very good point. Like I think a lot about the reconciliation and utilization of data. But in that example, whether it's me loading funds into my Wealthsimple account from a third-party bank account, or somebody accepting a payment from a customer, yeah, those days do matter in terms of where the money is sitting. And again, it's very opaque. But I also think about the fact that, you know, somebody's taking the risk there too. And oftentimes that risk is getting pushed out to the edges, sometimes onto the customer, but at a minimum, when I fund my Wealthsimple account onto Wealthsimple. And so moving that money faster again, obviates the need for them to build so much in that space because look, risk, and financial crime is a shared responsibility. And it's interesting because I think behind closed doors, if you were to ask the largest bank in this country, whether it's a shared responsibility, I think their answer would be that it's a proprietary advantage. And I don't think a single person in this country would ever describe the financial crime and, for lack of better phrasing, scam problem we have in this country and others as something that our largest financial institutions should think about as proprietary advantage.
Mm. What do you mean by that? Expand on the bank seeing it as an advantage versus maybe the average citizen not.
Geez, I'm way out over my skis here. You know, it's wild to me that there isn't more data being shared when money is transferred through Interac. And I suspect that the only reason that it's not being shared is because people don't want to share it because they feel like they have better data, better capabilities than the next person. But the only people that are losing are Canadians.
And that would be things like, what are some examples of the, you know, the kind of data in a fintech application when you transfer money, you know, in your dream world, we'd see just in real time?
I don't know that I have a great answer to that without exposing some of the things that I've seen in different client engagements that, you know, probably wouldn't want to talk about live in the same way that, you know, an underlying service provider probably wouldn't talk about like how they monitor for financial crime triggers and things like that.
Yeah.
But suffice to say, the data lag is real and it's inconsistent. And I think that is preventing us from taking, you know, financial crime into our hands as a fintech community, as a shared responsibility, because ultimately we don't control most of the data. We control a very small, minuscule amount of the data, just like we control a small, minuscule amount of the market today.
Yeah.
We should talk about that.
Yeah, we should.
Can we talk about that?
Sure. Let's transition to that.
I came in here today only wanting to ensure I covered one thing, and that's an abundance mindset. I saw a tweet the other day, and it was a gentleman asking about the safety of funds in like a neobank context. And I think really specifically, it was a small business focused neobank called Vault. And I went onto the thread and I explained to this person, who is a business owner, who's a very sophisticated person, obviously, and has had a lot of success, you know, how CDIC insurance worked and who the underlying sponsor bank of that fintech was, and that, you know, the relationship was being created with that underlying sponsor bank, and that's, you know, you should look in the footer of their of Vault's website, and you should understand who that sponsor bank is. In this case, it's People's Trust, of course. And it dawned on me that we have to do a much better job telling the story about why fintech matters, meaning, you know, what additional value are we providing in the market, but also just how it works. Because the how it works is very common across the entire industry, and it's very common across the globe too. And so I think just as an industry, we could do a much better job supporting one another and figuring out how to just grow the size of our little part of the pie. And I think it comes in the form of like an abundance mindset. It comes in the form of like being really clear about the customer value that we're providing instead of counterpositioning against the banks, right? We've seen a lot of that counterpositioning, and it doesn't work. It doesn't help your customer understand the why, and it doesn't create any urgency for them. And if we think we're creating value for them, we have to do a much better job expressing that. And then the third thing is just talent. Like, you know, the amount of talent in this country is unbelievable, and the more of that talent we can get working on financial services innovation, the better. So,
What's your level of optimism about the future of fintech in Canada, specifically as it relates to, you know, an opening of the frameworks to incentivize and support innovation, the ability for fintechs to partner with more than just one financial institution to build, you know, these products? Like, where do you see us trending, and what do you think we need to do? I had, you know, I was with Hannah Sadie yesterday. She's obviously got lots of great perspective on this, as do you. Like, where do you assess us now, and what do you think's got to change for it to get to a place where fintechs like Vault and Float and many others can continue to innovate in partnership with existing financial institutions to extend their capabilities?
Hannah's the reason I don't talk about open banking, because like she's said it all much better than I ever will. I think that it is in some ways about calendar time. Calendar time must pass, right? The more times that I drive by the Float billboards at Spadina and Adelaide, and others like me do, the more comfortable I get with replacing some of the things I used to do at my bank with float, and then acknowledging that there is a world where companies can provide financial services well beyond what you would have ever replaced, because they're doing it through the lens of the customer and building great software, right? You're a software company. You're competing on software. So I think calendar time, I think it's very, I think it's very important that companies like Wealthsimple and Coho and now Float are blazing a trail for others. I think it's important that folks like yourself and Hannah make sure that like the ramp is well extended behind you to bring others up so that we have an ever larger ecosystem. You know, 45% of a bank's revenue is non-interest income. We talked about that.
It's fees, transaction fees.
I don't know what the breakdown is, but I suspect that, you know, all of that should be in play for this ecosystem. And I also suspect that, and this is something that I picked up from you, we went to the Banker Summit maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago, and you were on a panel, and you made the point that the at-scale fintechs from other markets are coming. I was going to say the Americans are coming, right? Like, it's so super scary. But the Americans are coming. And unless we create the capacity and the conditions for competitiveness in this market, they're going to come here and they're going to be better financed, loaded up with talent. I mean, how many American fintechs have an office in Toronto focused on product development that has more than 20 or 30 employees that is effectively a branch office of their HQ and does not operate their service in Canada? Mm-hmm. There's handfuls of them. They're already here and they're taking our talent first. Now, it's not meant to be confrontational. I love those companies. I use those companies. I'm inspired by those companies. But the reality is that the longer we let this, the longer that we allow this market to be as concentrated as it is, and the longer we go sort of preventing fintechs from competing domestically in this market, the easier it's going to be for others to come into this market and beat both ourselves as well as the banks. I mean, we're all in this together, right? Ultimately, we're all Canadian and we all want to see our financial services continue to sector continue to grow and be as strong as it is. I'll make one point there, which is that Canadians are proud of their banking system, right? We always kind of wear that little patch about how we...
The 0809.
You know, 08, like our banks fared better than anybody else. And part of that is because of the work that OSFI does to maintain the safety and security of the system. And that's great, but we can't let that go too far. And I think this speaks to some of the challenge that we're going to have long run here, which is that, you know, as we add 400,000 or 500,000 new Canadians each year, those people are showing up and those big bank logos represent safety and they represent Canadianness. And we cannot just assume that those folks are going to come here and be interested in working with a fintech to do something that they otherwise, you know, might be able to do at a bank.
And what do you think the impact of, you know, you mentioned the, you know, so to speak, the Americans are coming. If in Canada, the landscape remains oligopolistic, concentrated among these few banks with really tight restrictions, you know, many of which we talked about, how does that change or not change the dynamic for a foreign company coming here? You know, we saw Revolut come to Canada and pull out. Do you think that that's a dynamic that will play out? Or do you actually think that American companies will come here and provide these services on a cross-border basis and just do it with U.S. issuing banks and U.S. partners and everyone in Canada, including the Canadian banks, loses that business?
That is a great question. I mean, there's going to be targets and there's going to be Costcos, right? Revolut was a target. They went in, they had to come back out because they didn't understand the market. I don't know when the last time you've been to Costco is, but they're doing pretty well in this country. They are coming, and some of them are going to be successful. Interesting point around, you know, how are they going to innovate on the model from a sponsor banking perspective? JPMC, JP Morgan Chase, they do a lot of this in the United States. You know, they power some of the very largest, and of course the bar is very high because of what JP Morgan represents in the banking industry, and you know, they are a Schedule II foreign bank here and have many of the same rights and privileges as a Schedule I bank, not all, but many of the same rights and privileges, including the ability to provide sponsor banking services. I drove in off the DVP to Richmond a couple of days ago to go do something, and I noticed Chase actually had like a payments acquiring ad, and you see the Chase Paytech terminals everywhere. At some point, these international fintechs that are at absolutely massive scale, some of which at just like unbelievable scale, like Nubank with 80 million customers, at some point they're going to land here and they're going to bring their friends with them. Mm. And a lot of those friends are already here in this country operating and have some of the rights and privileges that a Schedule I bank here would have in order to perform this type of activity. So I hadn't actually thought too much about that, but it's almost like they're just waiting for their moment, right?
I've definitely found historically that Canadians and Canadian institutions generally aren't competitive until an American firm or two come here and say, if you don't want to do this business, we'll do it.
I've thought about that so much in my own business. I think on the homepage of our website, which I built myself because I'm just like having fun, right? And I wish I was an engineer. I specifically at one point, you know, said that we were doing this, you know, in Canada with a focus on Canada. And I have had to think about and have been reminded many, many times that that's probably not great positioning for me even, because we're always sort of looking externally to validate ourselves. I can tell you that, you know, a handful of the largest fintechs in this country, their product leadership, their product leaders are sometimes Canadian, sometimes otherwise, but they're sitting in the United States and they live in the US and they bring the awareness of that market and the personal experiences that they have in that market up here. And that's a good thing in some ways. And in other ways, I think it's just indicative of even within our own ecosystem, unwillingness to take risks.
Yeah. And others will take them for us, maybe at the cost of, at the very least, as a Canadian citizen, your own financial system participating in that. It would be a drag if we woke up 5 to 10 years from now and had more of the innovation we wanted and it was all flowing across the border being served by Canadian or American companies, American banks.
Yep.
Definitely not the future environment that I think we're all driving towards. But this was fun. We probably could have kept chatting for like 2 hours.
For sure.
So we'll have to have you back on. But Jared, thanks a lot for doing this. Really appreciate it. Where can people find you if they want to chat?
I mean, I think Twitter's probably the best spot to find me, or in the West End of Toronto somewhere.
Awesome. Well, that wraps up this season of Retained Learnings. It's been a privilege to share the mic with some of Canada's most accomplished finance leaders, from the transformative power of AI in accounting to tackling burnout, navigating rapid business growth, and mastering team leadership. We've covered it all. If you enjoyed this season, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Stay connected with us on social media. Keep an eye out for updates on the next season. Until then, I'm Rob Kazam, wishing you continued success and growth in your finance journey. Thank you for listening to Retained Learnings. See you next season. Thank you for listening to this episode of Retained Learnings. We want to reach as many Canadian finance professionals as possible. So if you have 2 minutes to spare, we'd love for you to rate and review the new show. Sharing on social media helps too, and you can tag @Flowcard. I'm Rob Kazam, and until next time, take care.